Good morning. We'll call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Wednesday, March 30th, 2005. This morning we will have a program on children's mental health, and you know, it's an area that I think the legislature has been sort of working through quietly with the Children's Change Initiative and other areas sort of around the system, but we do need to do a more thorough job of working through all these issues and receiving, okay, she's the youngest one of all, and receiving a broader perspective. And to that end, we've invited, with the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy, we've invited Clark Luster out from, I think his home is in Kansas, to give us a discussion about an innovative approach to serving children in foster care. And we will have a public hearing on several bills around children's mental health and juvenile justice. So with that, I would like to invite Clark Luster forward and anybody who's going to be presenting with you. Have that list. And if you're wishing to speak on those other measures, you're signed up on the sign-up sheet on the side there. We may lose a couple of members at 9:30. Don't take it personally. They'll be back shortly. So, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name's Mary Monnet, and I am here today in the role of the current president of the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. The Alliance, I'm also the director at LifeWorks Northwest, which is a mental health and addiction service agency in Washington, Multnomah, and Clatsop counties. I want to talk just briefly about the Alliance, just to let you know who we represent. We're a statewide nonprofit association of children service providers. 33 members across the state provide over 250 programs serving Oregon's children. We touch the lives of 78,000 children and youth each year. Our services span those youth who are involved in the child welfare system, those in the homeless runaway youth system, developmental disabilities, mental health, substance abuse. Collectively, we provide over $150 million in services through the state of Oregon. As president, I just wanted to share in terms of why we're here today, what has led us to this point. We understand the dilemma Oregon's facing in terms of when we recognized going into the session that it was a cuts-only budget, essentially. We began to target the Alliance knowing better than to come forward with a dedicated tax, for instance, for children. We knew any of those discussions were not going to proceed, but we really wanted to take an action, frankly, that would get us out of feeling helpless and hopeless, because all of us in the Alliance, as well as all of you I know, are dedicated to what happens to Oregon's youth. We care greatly about the quality of services we provide. And frankly, we just felt like we don't want to sit here and just say, because this is a cuts-only budget, that there's not more we could be doing to improve quality. We have to take action. That led us to then be creative about, well, how might we proceed in this, in light of this? So we began to look externally to other states and to experts in the country who have had some experience with doing things differently. So our hope today is really to have a conversation, and rather than talk too much, we want you to hear from our guest, Clark Luster. But I just wanted to share with you that that's really the motivation. We want to work as the Alliance together with the legislature, with the various divisions, to make sure the services we are able to provide for youth are the most effective and efficient that they can be. So we're hoping then to come back and talk a little more after we hear from Clark. But I want to introduce Janet Ahrens, who's our executive director at the Alliance, who many of you may know.
Thank you very much, Chair Dalton and committee members. Janet Ahrens, the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. We wanted to thank Chair Dalton in particular for his commitment, not only during this session, but during the interim and early in his political career, for a clear commitment to children and a willingness to host these kinds of conversations, which often are sort of stirring the pot conversations in order to generate new ideas and other alternatives to the way the state is trying to solve problems and address the needs of the human service needs of children and families. And I'd like to introduce introduce Mr. Lester, although he doesn't like me to call him that. He keeps looking over his shoulder thinking his father is behind him. But Clark Lester is the president and CEO of the Kansas Children's Service League. They're an agency that serves over 50,000 children in the state of Kansas each year. Prior to that, he was the executive director of Presley Ridge, which is a $56 million agency that delivers services in six states in the east. He's also on contract in Florida to do consulting work to help them take a look at their effort to try and privatize foster care, and they've hit several bumps in the road in trying to do that, and so he is there to help them sort out what happened and to provide a report and recommendations to their legislature about that process and what occurred. So we'd like to have Mr. Lester talk to you a little bit about the work he's been doing, and entertain any questions you may have for us, and then we have a couple of closing remarks for you. Thank you.
Thanks, Janet and Mary. And thank you for your time this morning. I hope my presentation is going to be relatively short, and I hope we get into discussion with you and listen to your concerns and hopefully generate a dialogue. Over the past 2 days, I think I have met 30 or 40 staff or legislators. We had a reception last night, some of you there. We were back and forth across the hall yesterday. We met young legislators, staff, and some my age and maybe a little older, and on the Republican side and Democratic side. And frankly, being an outsider is interesting because I couldn't tell the difference. I couldn't tell you a Republican from a Democrat when I talked to them about children's issues. When I talked to them about whether we need to do more and better for the kids of state of Oregon, I couldn't tell you what persuasion they were. And I think that speaks well for the future of the system here. Well, I know we've got limitations, financial limitations and others, and I think the reason that Janet and Mary asked me to come out from Kansas is truly two reasons. One, I know a little bit about Oregon. I was here about 2 years ago and spent about 6 months here meeting and getting to know and some of the programs and some of these agency directors, and I know a little bit about the system as it exists. And secondly, I've had a wide range of experiences in the East Coast and most recently for the last 2 years in Kansas. Kansas is an interesting place for lots of reasons. It is, 2.5 years ago when I was out in Oregon working with some of you guys, I never had a hint that I'd end up in the heartland. It's been quite an experience for me. I've enjoyed it and have no regrets having done been out there the last couple of years. I believe that change, significant change in children's programs, is a result of desperation and that converging with strong leadership. That's what happened in Kansas. The desperation that they found themselves in the early 90s when they were faced with an ACLU suit that found how poorly the services to children in the state were. And that's not unusual, by the way. Many of you know that lots of states face court-ordered action. And Kansas' reaction to that was revolutionary. What they decided to do was a wholesale overhaul of the children's services system across the state. Kansas has a population of less than 3 million people, about 2.8 million, 600,000 people in Wichita. I tell the story when I first went to Kansas, the president of the board of the organization, I had a conversation. She asked, I asked her how big Wichita was. She said, you didn't know, and asked me how large I thought it was. I said, oh, about 30, 40,000 people. She said, no, it's much bigger than that. It must be at least 150,000 people, or 600,000 people in Wichita. We're in 28 cities. The agencies that I run, we're in 28 cities. I didn't know there were 28 cities in the state of Kansas at the time. They really revolutionized their system. And I'm not here, by the way, to hold out myself as an expert on much of anything. And I'm also not here to hold myself out as promoting the agenda of the state of Kansas being the answer for the state of Oregon. I just think there's some interesting ideas that have been implemented out there, and that the ideas are good. As a bald, gray-haired guy, it's been wonderful to learn a lot, and I've learned a lot out there in the last couple of years, and there are good things that are happening for kids and families as a result of some of the decisions that were made over the past 8 to 10 years. Let me talk about the system and how it was implemented. I really want to talk with you about outcomes, and I think I'll start there because I think that's the kind of thing that cuts to the quick of why the system was changed. In 1996, the state of Kansas did 292 adoptions. We are the statewide adoption contractor, and this past year we did 733 adoptions. Now, adoptions, I think we would all agree, are good things for kids. They give kids permanency, they give kids families, they give kids long-term stability. They also they save money, because once the kid's adopted, they're adopted, and they're not in the system, and that costs the system anything, or costing the system significantly less. The other thing that we have been most proud of is that the dissolution rate for adoptions nationally is about 12%. Our dissolution rate is less than 2%. So we're not only doing a lot of them, we're doing them well. And I'd rather do fewer of them and do them well, but we're doing both. And I've been particularly excited about that.
But what would be a reason why an adoption might fall apart?
Oh, it's 100 different things, Representative. It could be that we didn't do as good a match as we should have. Let me just tell one of the rumors about adoption. Lots of people think adoption is that little one back there in the corner. The average age of adoption of our youngster is 11 years old. So in the range is birth to 18. We also do sibling groups. Sibling groups have to be kept together. We don't split them apart, and the girls go to one family, the boy goes to the other. The initiative is keeping together. So why would adoptions be dissolved? Families dissolve, and the kid gets caught in the middle down the road. The husband and wife split up. More often what happens is people didn't understand what they were getting into. Lots of these kids, the kids coming to adoption contract are not kids whose 99 times out of 100 are not kids whose parents were killed in a car accident. What these kids are, whose kids have been in the system for many years, and we've done family reunification. We've put them in the foster care system and try to work with the family and keep the family together. And then finally the system said, that is not working. Now go find a family for the kid. These are tough kids. These aren't babies. And so dissolution happens. People didn't understand that they were getting a 16-year-old that had lots of problems and mental health issues and others. other outcomes that Kansas had a system, and I don't understand how it could have been this way, but people worked their 8-hour shift. The social workers, they worked for DSS. At 5 o'clock they went home. If somebody had a crisis, they either went to the police department or they waited until the next morning, dealt with them. Well, now the system is mandated. They have 24-hour response, both on the adoption side, foster care side. The rate that parents were paid then was $10. The rate now is at least double that for foster parents and more in many cases. I think a critical outcome is that 5 years ago, 67% of kids were in foster homes, and now 85% of them are in foster homes. So we're getting kids out of institutions, in other words. They're not in psychiatric hospitals or group facilities. They're really forcing them, the system is forcing them, in a good way, into foster homes and into adoptions, and we believe that's what it should be.
Can you take a moment maybe to give us an idea about how important the amount of money paid to foster families to help support those kids influences the outcomes of those placements?
I don't think you can pay people enough to do that kind of work. I don't believe you could pay them. You couldn't pay me several hundred dollars a day to do the kind of work we ask people to do for $20. It's amazing. The people come to this because of their heart, not because of their wallet. But when you're paying somebody $20, $25, $30 a day to take care of kids, some of these kids, particularly the adolescents, are eating $20 a day with food, so they're not into it for the money. On the other hand, we like to say we love when they buy a new van and with the money that we're paying them, and put a swimming pool in the back. Well, that means that they're not going to call us on Friday afternoons when things get tough, because they're going to think about the obligations that they've got. So we love to pay them enough money to make it be something that they don't just want to walk away from when times get tough. We believe in a graded system that if in some cases people would have 2-3, like if you had a sibling group, they might be having an income of 80, four kids, you'd have $80 to $100 a day coming in, but they're paying all expenses at that. So they're not, again, they're not making a whole lot of money. The short answer to your question is that in lots of cases with troubled kids, if you can pay a high level, highly supervised, well trained treatment parent significantly less than what they would have in what it would cost to have them in an institutional program, and still keep them in the community, keep them in their school, keep them connected with their family, moving toward normalcy. So grades are important, but I don't think it's a critical thing. Let me talk a little bit about the structure of the Kansas system. The assumptions that people had about it originally and the reality today. I've never heard anyone in Kansas say that they did this to save money, that the system was not moved toward what's now called a community-based partnership, because it was an effort to reduce costs at the state level. Cost was not reduced, and it has not been reduced. The justification now, and I'm a believer in it, and the state is a believer in it, is because the outcomes are better. I think that people who go into this naively are thinking that it's a money-saving exercise, but I assure you it is not. It's not for a couple of reasons. I think it's not because the system is underfunded to begin with, and when we're just privatizing or moving to a contracted system doesn't solve that problem. The mechanics of how this works is every 4 years the state of Kansas sends out an RFP, and the bidders respond to that. In this case, it was it took about a year for that process to wind its way to conclusion. There is a decision made by the state of who they're going to issue contracts to. Contracting is a it's a major to-do. You respond to the RFP. You have live demonstrations of your competency. There are financial negotiations, the decision made, and then there's a transition. We happen to be right now in the transition phase. There's a 6-month transition between the old contractor and the new contractor. And starting July 1st, the system will be what it'll be for the next 4 years. I'm going to stop. Yeah, let me talk a little bit about some of the creative things that have been built into the system to move youngsters toward permanency. Somebody asked me why we were able to do 733 adoptions last year. Well, we were incentivized to do 733 adoptions because the program is outcome based. It's there's a quarterly report that's called Portraits, and it gives a portrait to the legislature, to the child advocates, to my boss, who really. My boss is a guy who owns a bunch of hotels. He's not into kid business at all, but he's interested in kids. His motivation is a better system. And so I'm motivated to have my outcomes every quarter show that we're meeting the expectations of the state. The second thing, of course, I'm trying to do is meet my outcomes so that I get this contract renewed again in 4 years. So I've got that motivation to meet the outcomes. There are built-in motivators into the system. I think from your point of view, an interesting component of this is the ability to change contractors you're unhappy with. The ability from the administrative point of view or for the funder's point of view to say, well, we've got a contractor who's not meeting our expectation, and we're going to have somebody else do this. We've tried this for 4 years, or we've tried this for how many years we've tried it, and it's not meeting our expectation, and we're going to move and find someone else who can. The final thing I want to talk about of incentives, in this coming year's contract, they built in some kind of interesting possibilities into the contract. It's not a possibility, it's a reality. During the first 6 months that a youngster's in the program, we get paid 100% of our rate. During the second 6 months, we get 66% of our rate. And any time after that first 12 months, we only get 33% of our rate. And that's a motivator, obviously, to move the youngsters through the system, get them back home, or get them into a permanent adopted family. So there really are some creative ideas that would move the system to reducing cost, but more importantly, to do the best job for the kids. I think Janet is. Thank you so much for. I don't have a speech here, so this is all kind of responding to points that seem to be important. We were meeting with some of you yesterday. Somebody asked how we did that record number of adoption. Well, we've got flexibility. We don't bill Medicaid. We don't bill TANF. We don't bill 4E. We get a check from the state on a monthly basis. The state does all that. And so we've got immense flexibility. If we want to, if we need foster parents, we'll go out and get them. I mean, we can go market for them. We go recruit them. We have billboard campaigns. I mentioned yesterday, I've got 27 photographers, professional photographers in the state of Kansas, who've agreed to shoot portraits of our kids that need to be adopted. And we've not only did the kids get a great portrait that they normally wouldn't have had, my kids didn't have it, I didn't want to spend the $500 to get it done, but these kids have a record of their youth. But more importantly, we take those portraits and we have them in the Topeka Library, we've got them in the Manhattan Mall, with a little bio of these kids, and we move this gallery around the state, and use it as a way of marketing adoptions, and it's worked greatly. It's been a great thing. We have partnerships with 27 news organizations. They feature kids. We've got people on our. That we do a Wednesday's Child where we feature a kid, and it's just the motivator to move the system along and get kids' families and get them in a permanent situation. Questions, comments? Please,
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions relative to what you presented, Mr. Lester, and I appreciate it. My recollection is that Kansas was the first state, and perhaps you weren't involved in this, but you may know, where you were able to analyze the investments in these programs that were being made rather than the state, the local governments, county governments, and other nonprofit organizations which were making investments. And then the state of Kansas went out and captured that dollar amount, and was able to either use that dollar amount or enter into a pilot program with the federal government, that the federal government would allow those local payments to be used for a local match, and then send additional federal money. Did you participate?
No, we did not. I'm really unaware of that process. Now that. You know at what time that happened early on, or
that's been within the last two or three years, mm-hmm. that Kansas has been successful. They were the mm-hmm. first state in the nation mm-hmm. that were able to do that, and I've got a sneaking suspicion that probably the Kansas Children's Service League and programs like that mm-hmm. have been really successful in helping those pilot programs again mm-hmm. along. Again, a follow-up question with regard to medical insurance and other special education needs for those youngsters mm-hmm. that are in placement. Is that in addition to the amounts provided to those families?
Each of the youngsters has a Medicaid card, and so the primary medical care is provided through the medical card. Special education would be the responsibility of special ed, the Department of Education. Thirdly, any mental health costs. Now, one of our motivators, we get paid about an average of $88 a day. If I've got a youngster in a $25 a day foster home, I'm doing just fine. If I've got that kid in a $300 residential program, I'm losing money. So the motivator is to move those youngsters on, but we pay those expenses.
Mm-hmm.
In the new contract, the ones starting July 1st, though, they've carved out those high-end costs for inpatient residential, for residential treatment and inpatient, and that'll be billed by Medicaid. But currently, I pay those.
And another question with regard to a comment that you've made relative to the ability to change contractors with ease. Is that within the state contracting system that you've got set up so that if the state doesn't see the outcomes being achieved, then is there a warning system, and then...
Yeah, there is a corrective action plan. What most people, when they react to the Kansas story, there were a couple of bankruptcies early on. There were two agencies that went bankrupt in the process, and so when people think about the Kansas experiment, they think about that. We meet on a quarterly basis with the Secretary of the Treasury. They look over our financials, make sure that we're stable moving forward. Then there are corrective action steps that the state can take. You know, they talk about four-year contracts. Actually, there are four series of one-year contracts, and so we do write a renewal every year, and there have not ever been any that have been changed during that interim, but the state certainly has a right contractually to do that. But really, the massive change takes place every 4 years when the RFP is renewed.
Mr. Chair, final question.
Final question, sure.
Thank you. Mr. Director, I see a term that I'm not familiar with. It's the applied model of therapeutic foster care. Can you share with me what
I answered back when Representative Dalto asked me about the rate. Years and years ago, we created a model, kind of simple idea that competent families can take, competent, well-supervised, trained families can take care of a lot of very tough kids in a family situation, not necessarily in an institutional situation. The real benefit, we believe kids need to learn to live in families, not in institutions, and so we created a model that lots of very troubled kids who historically might have been in residential programs were in families. And we did things like increase the payment. We reduced the caseload on the caseworker. We intensified training, and there's now... That's a model that's really become a national. There's some here. People are doing it here in Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay.
If I might comment, one of the reasons that we were so interested in what Clark Lester had to tell us about Kansas is because there are a number of elements there that are not present or not as strong in Oregon's system, and we think that that's probably a principle that's true in other children's service systems as well. So part of what we wanted to do with our conversation today and sharing some of this information, again, wasn't around promoting a particular model, but around stirring the pot so that we can start to look at what other states are doing, what other things are happening, what we should be considering doing. There are, while there have been many challenges, and we've been referring to them as alligators, and making these kinds of major system changes, and states who made them for the wrong reasons or didn't think through the right questions they needed to be asking before they made the changes. One of the reasons he mentioned he was in Florida is because they ran into big problems there when they, under a lot of intense political and media scrutiny, decided to make also a radical change in their foster care system. So we're concerned not only that we take a look at the ideas, but that we also understand where the potential pitfalls are and that we have appropriate and realistic expectations for the changes that we make, and that they are based on the best interests of the children, and that we've got reasonable expectations for outcomes. It's key, I think, to the accountability piece, and we really want to emphasize that. One of the other pieces that's also very interesting about Kansas is that, and Clark was alluding to this, they assume all the risk. Now, the state of Kansas keeps the CPS, the Child Protective Services piece, but all the foster care, all the adoption, all the prevention work on the front end to try and preserve families and keep them together is all done in the private sector. They bring flexibility and some other abilities to the table to try and achieve those things, and must be able to demonstrate their outcomes. They also have no eject policies, which is basically the one that the State of Oregon Department of Human Services has to operate under. They don't get to choose who comes in, how sick they are, what their needs are, how challenging they may be. They simply have the responsibility for assuming their care and their custody and getting them in the best possible placement for future success. So all of those risks and all those expectations carried through to the private sector when they picked up when they participated in this revolution in Kansas. We think that this principle of evaluating how the state delivers some of its services for children, and whether or not there are other ideas out there and other ways to do this in other states, it is a good process in such tight budget times when it's so challenging. We really have to be able to demonstrate to taxpayers and to kids and families that the best possible decisions are made for the best possible outcomes, and that's really why we're here. That's really our message in this. And foster care certainly is an area in child welfare that Clark is well versed in, and that the state of Oregon has been struggling with. But again, we think this is a bigger principle, and I hope you'll consider other places where we might be able to apply it. Mary, do you have comments?
Just, I want to thank Chair Dalto and members of the committee for this time, showing your commitment to children. We've been again, around the building, and hoping to take this in terms of some next steps to hopefully looking at this further. We recognize in terms of process we're way into the session, so we have no agenda in terms of necessarily this anything happening right now, but are interested in just the leadership you all provide in helping us carry this forward, doing some work on this together so we really make sure all our investments in Oregon's youth are doing the best they can with the limited resources available.
And Chair Dalton, committee members, in regards to that action, we are hoping to build enough interest and momentum in taking a look at the ideas from other states so that we may be able to work with the legislature during the interim to see what we might be able to cut and paste or morph for Oregon, whether it's amending how the state of Oregon delivers some of these services or how other people might be able to deliver them. So we're looking forward to an opportunity to speak with you all further about this after the hearing today and see what kind of support and momentum we may be able to get towards that end.
We have a couple of questions on the panel.
Great.
First, I'll ask the first question. I wanted to know, in terms of Kansas, what role, if any, does methamphetamines play in the families, and has that epidemic touched Kansas as it has really dominated what we have to deal with here?
I'm on a task force right now to deal with that. Yes, it's a serious problem in Kansas and the rural areas, particularly. We just brought a task force of the police chief, the mayor, all the human service people together to focus on that. We're going to do an initiative for birth mothers that are meth addicted. We're going to do a screening, we've got this group of about 20 of us that are going to retreat for a week in May to focus on that issue right there.
Does the involvement of meth in how it affects those kids, I mean, I imagine that it makes the foster placement much, much more challenging. Some of the issues that you have to contend with much, much more challenging. So I guess what I'd like to know is how we compare, well, how Kansas compares to Oregon in terms of the number of sort of meth-affected kids entering the foster system and how the level of care in a privatization model might differ.
I think as Janet Aaron said a second ago, we don't have a choice. If a youngster's in our geographical area, we have responsibility for them regardless of their problems or issues. So meth-addicted parents are an issue we deal with every day. I think the real issue, critical issue, is the fact that we've got a commitment to keeping those kids integrated in with their families, whether in a foster home and even in adopted homes. And the real issue we're struggling with is how to keep those kids connected while their parents are still addicted.
Representative Cameron and then Anderson.
Yeah, Janet, I just, and maybe it's a question that you can answer, or Mr. Lester. You mentioned alligators. I think in Oregon we have spotted owls. What are some of those, I could just see going from where we're at today to privatization, what are some of those alligators that Florida has stepped on and maybe relating to our situation, if you have any insight to that?
Chair Dalton and Representative Cameron, I think Clark can answer that best.
I think one of the first mistakes or assumptions that Kansas made was that they thought they had people that could do this work when they privatized. They made a bunch of assumptions about that the state workers would go work in the contracted services, and it didn't happen. So what ended up, the private agencies ended up doing was hiring brand new staff, young kids right out of college typically, who had no experience. They had the toughest kids that were going through a transition, and it was chaos. The morning that the message and communication was very, very poor. They didn't bring the judges into the conversation until way too late, and so the judges were resistant to the process, and of course the judges were the ones who made the final determination of the cases. And So the state workers stayed as state employees, and now that the casework was off the caseload, they had more time to do CPS, because CPS, Child Protective Services, is still the purview of the state. They went and found more kids because they had more time that they never had before, so more kids came into the system. So the people who bid on, let's say, 1,000 kids in their system ended up with 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 kids, because the CPS function that hadn't been done appropriately, because they had mixed caseloads of foster care and adoption on their caseload, and more kids came into the system. That has all balanced out now over the years, and what's happening, no state employees lost their job. What they're doing now is prevention. Those people are still doing CPS and doing prevention and keeping kids out of the system. So early on, you need to communicate. You need to communicate with all the parties. You need to particularly the judges, and you make sure you got a workforce that's going to do this work.
Thank you.
Chair Dalto and Representative Cameron, just to add to that, Clark referenced this briefly in his opening remarks, but some nonprofit organizations failed as a result of their attempt to participate in this new process. So the alligators bit where the spotted owls landed on all of the involved parties. I mean, everybody learned a lot. The private community and the public community learned a lot from the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really like the ideas that I've heard, some creative things about drawing in professional, I assume, photographers and using Give Billboards to recruit. Those are great ideas. I'm hearing that you're basically saying that private contracts don't work, or that they haven't worked in some situations, but we need to use them more. Could you talk a little bit?
Oh, I think they work in terms of outcomes. I'm a firm believer in that private contracts provide the opportunity to produce better outcomes for kids. I mean, my example, we do twice as many adoptions as used to be done. I just think that it's not a panacea. The transitions aren't easy, but I think the motivators are there, the incentives are there, and the outcomes have proven themselves.
That if you take time in picking your contractors and work, the judges get into it early, and everybody else, that it can, in fact, work out well. Mm-hmm. Can I follow with another question of a little different line? You mentioned you had 733 adoptions last year. Could you compare a little bit between Ms. Aaron's two, how many foster care children you have from which those 733 were adopted, and then how are we doing in Oregon? How many foster children, how many adoptions approximately? Just guesstimates.
There are about 9,000 kids in the system, total foster care youngsters in the system, and that would be, whatever that be, 8% or something, would be adopted.
Okay.
We've still got, there's still 600 kids waiting to be adopted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've still got work to do. I don't know whether you want me to go down this road or not, but the new contract is going to change a couple of things. One of the things the July 1st contract is going to do, in the current system, when a youngster is in the foster care contract and it's decided that they would appropriate for adoption, they switch systems. They switch from the foster care contractor to the adoption contractor. And it's the belief that that slows the adoption process down. So in the new contract, the worker, the caseworker, will stay with the kid. So if a kid starts in foster care, the worker will stay with that kid all the way through to adoption. What the adoption contractor will do, what we as adoption contractor will do, we will recruit families and make a match and then follow up after. But the effort, you know, it's a way to tweak the system every 4 years to make it more efficient, make it more quick, get kids to permanence quicker.
Chair Dalton, Representative Anderson. We have a comparable number of children in foster care in Oregon. About 90% of those children are served by the State of Oregon Department of Human Services, and about 10% by private providers who are licensed to provide foster care in the state. I do not know the number of children, percentage of children who are facing adoption out of those 9,000.
Could I follow up?
Thank you.
About 8,000, 1,000, something like that?
Approximately.
And who are the private contractors? Are we talking Holt? Are we talking...
Chair Dalton, Representative Anderson, I don't believe Holt, they do adoptions, but I don't believe they do foster care. There are some providers in this room who provide foster care. We provide some foster care through the juvenile justice system as well as through the Department of Human Services. There are a handful of agencies who are licensed to provide foster care. Some are very small numbers. Some may only be 5 or 10. Some may be significant. In fact, we do have a network in the Portland area of 3 nonprofit agencies that have probably the lion's share of the amount of foster care beds that are privately managed.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lester, let me follow up on something I think I just heard you say. Originally, the caseworker, the state workers, handled both the Children's Protective Services and the adoption. Now the situation is you funded a new set of agencies on a special contract to do the adoption, but there's the same number of workers working in the same system before. How much money did that add to the system for the addition of the contracts now that Children Protective Services can do what they should be doing?
I'm not sure the dollar, Representative Greenlee, what the actual dollar is. I'm not sure what it is. They have reduced the staff over time by attrition on the state side. But what did not happen was that first none of those state workers were terminated when the contracts started, and secondly, they didn't switch to the contracts. So any reduction in the number of state employees is a result of attrition, and they've really redirected them into prevention, keeping kids out of the system.
If I could follow up on that a little bit. Yeah, I mean, we've heard that our caseworkers are overburdened.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question if we had a big chunk of money
mm-hmm.
to add mm-hmm. the adoption piece and contract that out, then mm-hmm. our state workers could do a better job at protective services. But mm-hmm. I'm trying to get some idea of the order of magnitude. We're about the same size system. I mean, is this an extra $50 million?
The total amount, I do not know the answer to your question. I can tell you the contracts are $125 million total contracts. It's a $30 million adoption contract, and the $95 million spread across family preservation and foster care.
So if I can just follow up, then if we could find another $125 million to put into our system, that would allow a more effective adoption model and at the same time release the children protective workers to do the kind of thing we're worried about, to protect the kids against murderous parents and a variety of things like that. That might be the easy solution for us.
I'm not sure I'm prepared to agree or not agree with what the right amount number is, because I don't know what it started yet. I think it
the 50 million.
Say. It's a chunk of change. Yeah. It's a good piece of money. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, I recommend we find that.
Well, open up your checkbook. Right. Well, any other comments or questions by the committee?
Chair Dalton, my apologies. May I just a little add-on to that? The other services that they're able to provide these children in Kansas include an attorney for going through the adoption adoption proceedings and court appearances. They have ad litem support, and they also have CASA support. And it's very, very challenging in the state of Oregon right now to find an ability to be able to provide those same services, even though the state recognizes their value. So that is an additional factor in the costs and the work and services that Kansas is able to provide.
I'm very worried about those services for our kids here, in fact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much. And thank you, Alan. Thanks so much to Clark Luster for coming out all this way to share some perspective with us. Very informative presentation.
Thank you again for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Are you going to step out at 9:30? Yeah, no, that's fine. Are you stepping out at 9:30? Yeah, okay. All right, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2640. And we're going to lose a couple of members for a few minutes, but we'll keep the show going. So, Sandy, would you introduce 2640 to us, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2640 comes to us at the request of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers. This is allowing certain providers, psychiatric intensive care treatment service centers for children to obtain liability coverage in the same current manner as providers of residential treatment services for children. This has an emergency clause and is effective upon passage.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sandy. And we have two people signed up to testify, so we'll invite Mr. Bruce Bishop forward with the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers, Mr. Larry Tang as well with the Polk Adolescent Day Treatment Center. And welcome you both this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for scheduling a public hearing on House Bill 2640 and for allowing us an opportunity to testify on this bill. To the extent possible, I would like to facilitate the committee's consideration of this bill and hope that you can set a committee record for expeditious conduct and approval of it. In part, that's because we previously testified on this issue in early February. We talked about this issue, and the committee was gracious enough to introduce this bill separately because the bill that we were addressing before was felt by legislative council not to be appropriate. So the committee came forward with this bill as a freestanding bill, and we appreciate that support. This bill is a small step. It's a step that would treat day treatment providers the same as residential treatment providers for the purposes of accessing liability insurance coverage, which is a growing expense for nonprofit programs. But it would allow them to pool, as local governments can pool, through state insurance purchasing. It's a small step. It's a way to help some of the programs keep their liability costs down. We would urge the committee's support of the bill as drafted, and would be glad to answer any questions you have. Mr. Tang is with me this morning as well, and would be able to answer your questions if you have any.
Thank you. Bruce, tell me what the situation is now that this would rectify.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, presently day treatment programs such as Mr. Tang's in Polk County have to get their own liability coverage. So they pay whatever premiums the market tells them they have to pay. What this allows them to do is to join a pool that's administered through the Department of Administrative Services if that pool can arrange for lower cost liability cost coverage for them.
Thank you. Okay. Mr.
Yes.
Chair, is there anybody who's going to be speaking opposed to this bill?
I don't think so. This bill is a product of an amendment that we invited Mr. Bishop to seek because we couldn't amend the previous bill that we were working on. So I think this is a pretty narrow bill to resolve a problem for providers like Mr. Tang. This bill has a subsequent referral to Business, Labor, Consumer Affairs. I'm not especially convinced that we need to send it there afterwards so we can do a little work to see if we can just move this out to the floor and get this through to get some assistance and relief to folks. I'm not aware of any opposition. Are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Mr. Tandy, do you have anything to add?
Nothing to add other than those costs do rise considerably over each budget year, and sometimes a 20% to 30% increases, so the opportunity to explore this option would be a big benefit, so we appreciate your support.
Okay, we'll excuse me? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bishop, your written testimony, which is great, refers to House Bill 2254. Is that a typo?
Thank you very much. I meant to mention that what I've given you is the testimony that we presented previously on 2254. It's got the February date on it, but it's intended to be applicable to House Bill 2640.
Thank you.
Just to show that there was continuity and we had addressed the issue previously.
All right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put this up on Monday for a work session, and my intention is to work it out on Monday. You have a task before Monday, and the task is to go and seek a rescinding of the subsequent referral to Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. We'll move it out one way or another on Monday, either directly to the floor or to the Business Committee, depending on what you are able to accomplish between now and then. Sound fair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate you both for being here. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2640. And we have... we had a few members step out for another commitment, but I know they wanted to participate on these other measures. So we'll stand at ease for 10 minutes. Thanks. We'll call the House Committee on Health and Human Services back to order. We just completed a public hearing on House Bill 2640 regarding liability insurance for intensive day treatment providers. And we're going to take up House Bill 2362 now, which is the task force bill to look at the innovation of funding for services to children with severe emotional and mental disorders. We have quite a number of people that are signed up to testify on this measure. We're going to bring folks up in panels. Looks like there's going to be, I think, three panels. And the first panel will have Bob Junedep, Mark McKechnie, and Jim Russell on that panel, if I've read that right. So I will invite that panel forward at this time and get us started. We may have four panels, I'm not sure. Good morning, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedep. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center, and I want to thank you for hearing this bill today. I am not an expert on children's mental health, nor the funding of children's mental health, and so my remarks are really introductory in saying how we got here today. As an advocate, our office assists children with mental health needs, and over the years we have found that there are many children who are unable to get the services that they need. That brought us to being lawyers, basically, and since every problem looks like a nail to a hammer, we thought, gee, a lawsuit would be just the thing to do here. What we found when we threatened a lawsuit was that, in fact, everybody agreed with us, that the system had some problems that interfered with children getting the services that they need, and people really wanted to work on overcoming those problems. And we jumped right in. The first time you saw us on this had to do with that magic budget note that dealt with services for children with intensive mental health needs last session. We worked with other advocates and providers to try to move that through in order to encourage changes in the delivery system for children with mental health. As that process rolled out as a result of the budget note, we got to know folks much better within the delivery system, and what we found was that, without exception, everyone said, you know, what we really need to do is move to a new way of funding these services that are children-centered and family-centered, and can so that resources can be pooled from various parts of the system and so that kids can get what they need. And our response was, gee, if everybody, and I mean everybody, thinks this is a good idea, why can't we get where we need to get? And, of course, just because something's a good idea doesn't mean it's not complicated. to achieve the change. And so what we need to do, and what everybody we have talked to said, you know, we need to get everybody together at the table who had the expertise and knowledge in this area to see how we can do it here in Oregon. And that is what the purpose of House Bill 2362 is. Now, one of the complications that we've learned since we filed this, or asked that this bill be heard, is that, of course, getting together and talking about an issue costs some money, costs some staffing. Staffing such a work group or a task force can have a fiscal impact. And that is why we've been working on some amendments to try to ease that impact and to really to come to you today to explain how important it is that we take this opportunity to move ahead in the planning for system change. Something that we can do now in times of fiscal austerity that can result in a system that works more efficiently and gets kids the services that they need more effectively. This is a great time to undertake this, and we would urge you to consider it as something that this committee or other some portion of the legislature can take on during the interim so that we can be prepared 2 years from now to move ahead. And with that, I'd like to hand it off to Mark McKechnie, who can start the conversation that adds some flesh to the bones of what I just laid out.
For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm a social worker at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I'm also chair of the Legislative Committee of the National Association of Social Workers, the Oregon chapter. And I'm here on behalf of both organizations to express our support for House Bill 2362. Now that Bob has explained the bill and what it seeks to do, I will talk a little bit about the need I see for this approach, and also some of the kinds of results that have been seen in other states when they have taken similar approaches. I've been an advocate at the Juvenile Rights Project for over 6 years now. We work with children and youth in the juvenile court system in Multnomah County, so they're in foster care or the delinquency system. I work on a weekly basis to try to access services on behalf of those children and their families in some cases. And what I find from the public systems that serve them is that often there's a failure to provide services that are timely, adequate, and appropriate for the individual needs of each child and family. Unfortunately, what I see personally and what we see among the population we serve both locally in the Portland area, around the state of Oregon, and nationally are very poor outcomes for children in general who are involved in juvenile court systems. And in particular for those children, and there are many, who have serious mental, emotional, and behavioral disorders, we see some of the worst outcomes. Many, many of them fail to finish school, so that sets them off on the wrong foot for adulthood. The result is that a substantial percentage of our homeless populations are former foster children. A substantial percentage of inmates in our prisons are former foster children. And a substantial portion of the adults who receive public assistance from our various public agencies and who are the parents in our child welfare system were themselves former foster children. As Bob mentioned, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services has been planning, pursuant to the 2003 budget note, to better integrate services within the mental health system. And we're very excited to see those changes come to fruition starting later this year. It's a very important step that's been, in my opinion, about a decade overdue, that we need to integrate the various levels and types of care within the mental health system to better serve children and families so that services are delivered in a flexible and responsive way to individual needs. And I see that the changes pursuant to the budget note as a good foundation for what House Bill 2362 seeks to do as a next step, which is to then integrate across the systems, not just within the mental health system, but mental health with child welfare, with juvenile justice, with our health system, and with developmental disabilities, and in particular the school systems that serve all of these children. JRP serves about 3,000 children and youth in Multnomah County each year. Our attorneys represent them in the juvenile court locally, and we see the children with serious mental and emotional disorders in particular failing most often to be reunited with their parents or to be able to be placed with aunts and uncles and grandparents and other extended family. And even when those family aren't available, we see these children unable to achieve any kind of permanent placement with a foster family or an adoptive family. And unfortunately, we see these children in early adolescence too often graduating into the juvenile justice system.
Mark, can I stop you for a second? We're having a technical problem with the audio system, and I've not encountered it before. We can hear you fine, but the tape isn't recording the conversation for some reason, so I just wanted to get some guidance from the clerk's office. Why don't you go, Pamela, will you call Ramona? We'll stand at ease for a moment. Is it working now?
We all need nerds. That's the key.
All right. We'll call the committee back to order. We'll continue on with Mr. McKechnie's presentation. Sorry about that interruption. And go right ahead.
Okay, I'll pick up where I left off. I've set up the scenario among our clients with very serious mental and emotional disorders, often failing to land anywhere permanently, whether it's returning to a family or a long-term foster home or an adoptive home. And what pains me in seeing this happen again and again is knowing that other states have figured out, and I think you heard a little bit this morning how Kansas has set up a somewhat different system than Oregon has. They work with a broader population than we're talking about this morning, but they would serve some of the same kinds of children as well in a more coordinated fashion than Oregon is currently able to serve them. And so what we know is that several other states have adopted approaches like that, Minnesota, California, or a couple other states that have integrated systems for delivering services to children with serious mental health disorders, and they bring the resources of the different systems together to meet the needs of the children, however they may manifest, because there are individual needs that differ from child to child and family to family. In particular, I want to talk about a couple efforts that have been remarkably successful and can help lead the way, I think, for Oregon to see how we can better integrate our service systems here. A research group in California, the California Institute for Mental Health, the U.S. Surgeon General's report from 1999, as well as the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, have highlighted the effectiveness of some evidence-based practices, a couple in particular that are geared towards the needs of children in the foster care and the juvenile justice system who have serious mental and emotional disorders, are treatment, foster care, and wraparound. And I wanted to talk specifically about wraparound Milwaukee. There are also more details in my written testimony that I've submitted that I won't go over now. But briefly, in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, a program called Wraparound Milwaukee pools funding from their public mental health system, from juvenile justice and child welfare, pool all of that, all of those dollars together, and they give access to the, to those funds to case managers who work directly with families to identify their needs and to purchase or broker services that meet the individual needs of the child and family as it's identified by the family. And it's very important to recognize that Wraparound Milwaukee serves some of the most severely mentally ill children, youth with some of the most severe delinquent behaviors, including fire setting and other dangerous behaviors, and children who don't have a permanent home as their anchor. And they've been very successful. The court has been a key player in the Wraparound Milwaukee system because they see good outcomes for the youth served. In Milwaukee, the judges actually will commit some children and youth to Wraparound Milwaukee for services. And they've been able to dramatically lower costs because they see good outcomes. They serve children in their homes and in their communities much more often and have drastically reduced the use of hospital care, residential care, and the use of detention for youth who've been committed on delinquent offenses in particular. I've included more detail on that program, including the costs and the outcomes, in my written testimony. I've also attached to the back of my written testimony data on three clients of the Juvenile Rights Project with whom I've personally worked. And you will see that the cost of residential treatment alone for these three young adolescent girls already approaches $1 million. And you can see the length of time that they've each spent in residential settings. And that doesn't include the costs of foster care, outpatient mental health, medication, and education they received during times when they've been in the community. My understanding in these cases, my knowledge of the history of them, tells me that they've spent so much time in those institutions and less time in the community, partly because of a lack of mental health services in the community that are appropriate for them and support them when they're discharged from those programs. But there's also a failure in coordination between the child welfare system, which is their custodian, the mental health system, and the education systems in particular.
Representative Greenlee.
Can I interrupt just a moment? I mean, you're making a very strong case for doing something about a screwed-up mental health system for adolescents, but we're here today to talk about a bill that creates a task force. And I wonder if somewhere along the line the three of you could talk about why a task force. I mean, we had Senate Bill 267, which requires expenditures on evidence-based system, reproducing evidence-based tactics. Okay, we ought to go do those. We had about a governor's commission on mental health. We had the interim process on the integration. Isn't it time for us to be looking at suggestions about how to change the system rather than creating an 18-month task force that is not likely to produce anything we don't already know?
Representative Greenlee, Chair Dalto, my answer to that, and I will let Bob or Jim answer as well if they differ, but our intent and our hope is really to have a group that will design these changes specifically, not study them or talk about them. As Bob mentioned, there's almost unprecedented agreement among the various parts of the children's system that this kind of approach is necessary and appropriate. Nonetheless, that doesn't make it uncomplicated to accomplish. So my vision of the task force or the work group, one reason I use the term task force in terms of completing a task and not studying a problem, would be to design the mechanisms that allow the blended funding to support integrated services. And the complexities, we're talking about blending federal and state funding, and we want to make sure that we can do it efficiently and legally. We're talking about funding streams from Title 19 Medicaid, 4E child welfare funds, general education, special education, other funds for health and disabilities, and we want to make sure that we do it the right way and avoid some of the pitfalls that were referred to this morning. So that's my response to the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Greenlight, I'd echo that. And the complexities are involved, as you might expect, in trying to marshal resources from various parts of the system and bring them into one place. And that invariably means somebody's going to be giving up control of particular control of expenditure as it moves to another place where it can be used more effectively. And I believe that in order to accomplish that, we need to have a firm plan that does it, but also have the support of the legislature and support of the governor to make it happen, because it requires some political will to move that type of reform ahead.
Right. My only comment is I think testimony on how screwed up the system is okay, but we've been hearing that. What I really hope our witnesses will focus on is how this bill will move us in the direction we need to move. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's an appropriate observation, Representative Greenlight, especially given the time crunch that was necessitated by, well, that was a result of some of our technical problems earlier today. So if I could ask you to focus your comments, and we'll get through the panel. There's about 9 or 10 people to sign up to testify. So thanks. Okay.
Yes, I'd like to wrap up. Two people who couldn't be here today who wish to testify are Judge Nan Waller from the Multnomah County Circuit Court, and I've submitted her written testimony. Also, Dr. Larry Marks, a psychiatrist from Oregon Health and Science University, who works with the Portland Public Schools as well. We, along with others in Multnomah County, have been involved in an effort after we learned about Wraparound Milwaukee, which I've been describing, to develop a similar approach in Multnomah County. And certainly the mental health changes happening this year will be a great boon to that effort in allowing us to serve children and youth in our county more appropriately. But the result of this process envisioned under 2362 would take that effort much further in coordinating the resources of all the different systems locally: education, mental health, juvenile justice, child welfare, health and developmental disabilities, so that we can, that effort and others around the state that would also like to make similar efforts could flourish and succeed. We're very much hoping for the opportunity to have a more integrated approach among the children's service systems. And I noted that members of this committee, Representative Anderson, Boone, and Butler, are co-sponsors of House Bill 3422, which I think has some similar goals in blending federal, state, and local funds in the mental health system so that the consumers of that system can be better served. And this is a similar effort, hoping to plan and create an infrastructure at the state level to allow those kinds of efforts to be successful. Again, we will continue to see the same outcomes that we see, that I described, if we don't take these steps, I believe. And I just want to reiterate my support for 2362 on behalf of the Juvenile Rights Project and Oregon NASW. Thanks for taking my testimony, and I'd be glad to answer more questions.
Thanks, Mark. Jim.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Just briefly, Mark, could you just, what is the wraparound program?
A wraparound program usually has one case manager who works with a family and child, and they have, there are different ways to do it, but in Milwaukee, for example, they have access to a pool of funds that they can pay for various mental health services, in-home supports, crisis services, crisis prevention services, foster care, including the whole range of traditional services as well. Milwaukee, like the Kansas model that was described this morning, also bears the risk, the financial risk, so that they have an incentive to provide preventative services earlier that will be at a lower cost, or else they pay the price later if there are more negative outcomes. So, for example, if a child is hospitalized, they will pay the cost of hospital care out of that pool of money.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Chair Dalton, members of the committee, my name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, which is a mental health organization offering Oregon health plan services in a five-county region around this part of the state. I appreciate the question that Representative Greenlick, the question and the answer especially. I think that is the core of this bill, is to create an implementation plan that will accomplish the results that are being described as desirable. I just wanted you to hear directly from a mental health organization today that we would favor this initiative and the intention of this bill. Currently, you've heard about the children's system change. That brings the mental health organization some responsibilities, and currently we're the one charged with bringing about the community organization of all these different entities. But there's not a commensurate requirement at the state level for them to be involved with us. In fact, this does happen very commonly around Oregon. There are community-based interagency organizations talking about how can we meet the needs for these kids. People do bring their resources to the table to the extent possible, but often they are bound by their particular state agency from bringing the full possibility from what they could bring to a particular child and family. And so I think that an implementation plan moves where we are today a couple of steps forward. No longer would it only be the mental health organizations that are required to somehow coordinate all these pieces. Each of these pieces would be required to work together. And also some of the barriers that restrict the ability to collaborate financially, we could plan how to address that better. So I think that's all you need to hear from me. I knew you'd have great testimony from these gentlemen, so I didn't prepare anything in writing.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Jim. Any questions, Representative Green?
Yeah. Can we talk about the specifics of the bill? Is this the right panel to ask some questions about what the bill actually says? Or is there somebody else that's...
We have the authors.
On page two, I'm trying to find the heart of the plan. I think the heart of the plan, the heart of the task force is page two, line 37 through page three, line 7 or 8. Is that... You don't have a copy?
Chair Delta, Representative Greenlick, we're up here without a copy of the bill. We could...
I have an extra.
Again, that page...
The second page, line 37. The clue that I have is it says the purpose of the task force...
Yes.
And it says the purpose of the task force is to develop a coordinated plan. It says that. And then it talks about in carrying out that purpose, your task force will study the development and implementation of a mental health fund and be an integrated system, study these things. What do you imagine that plan is going to look like? I mean, is that going to be a plan that will... It says you need to report to the legislature by October, but will that plan be, say, take these agencies out of this place and put them somewhere else? Or what do you imagine that plan will be like?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, I've looked at a few other states' examples, and I think part of the task of this group will be to figure out something that Oregon, and there will be some things that we can adapt from other states that fit Oregon, and some that we will have to develop on our own. As Jim mentioned, there are when local systems and local providers and agency representatives work together and try to coordinate their funding, they face barriers in terms of eligibility for services and limits on what particular funds can be spent on which types of services. In Minnesota, what they did was develop a pool of funds at the state level so that those could be they can be combined legally, meeting the various requirements of the funding streams, and then that fund could be accessed, and there would be local groups.
That's probably AM 45.
Yes. And doing that at the state level would then create a criteria for a local community to develop a group, which I assume would involve interagency agreements among the county and local agencies, on how they would deliver services using those funds in a coordinated fashion. So the structure of the fund at the state level and the requirements of a local community to be able to access those funds, I see as two specific tasks that would need to be determined by the work group.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, so there isn't, I mean, other than maybe the Kansas plan or the Minnesota plan that we've talked about, there isn't a state who's doing this effectively and getting the water to the end of the road, getting the job done right on a regular basis that we can look to and attempt to model for the next 18 months while we're studying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't know if I could answer that question definitively. My concern is that each state is somewhat unique in the way they structure child welfare, mental health, juvenile justice, for example. In Milwaukee County, they were able to do it more quickly because those three systems were county systems, so it could be done within the county. In Oregon, we have a state child welfare system and a county mental health system, and then a sort of hybrid county and state juvenile justice system, depending on the level of custody and supervision. So we would have to figure out some of those particulars. California also has a system. I don't think California is like any other state in the country, and it would be hard to believe that we could adapt what they've done to Oregon. And as was also mentioned this morning, there are some other states that are under settlement or consent agreements or court orders that have been forced to do this kind of thing, and we could also look at those. But I don't personally know a scheme that we could just adopt as a package right away.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, when we looked at this, we did look at the statutory structures of some other states, and that's exactly what we found, is that they were overlaid upon your existing systems, which are not the same as Oregon's. And so we thought, well, we need to figure out how to make this fit in Oregon. And number two, since it affects so many agencies, to have buy-in from those agencies. And to us, that meant getting a bunch of people together and looking at it, who know what they're doing, and putting together a scheme to get it done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I'm just anxious about the fact that we tend to study these things, and if rather than develop a study, and I appreciate the fact that the bill provides that somebody from the governor's office will be there bringing the imprimatur of the governor to the table, but I'm anxious also that the legislature is set up uniquely to provide legislation to get things done. And if our legislative structure, if our statutory structure is not presently set up to get the job done, and we need legislative change, then I'd much rather find something that works and say, let's have a bill, even a committee bill, that says let's change it so that we can begin to do that. And I appreciate the fact that you're anxious to get buy-in from a half a dozen other state agencies. But if they're not getting the job done, then the stick that we hold over their head is we're gonna show you a system that works, and we're gonna have the hearings. So I'm anxious that we'll come back and again in 2 years and have hearings about the recommendations of this task force, which will be what you folks are telling us today we really need to do.
Okay, thanks, Representative Butler. We're going to have to wrap this up, so thanks very much to this panel. Next, I'll ask Madeline Olson to come up with the Department of Human Services and have Madeline just speak very briefly, and then we have a panel of parent advocates after that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Well, the next panel is coming up. Could I just read into the record several items? I have a communication that I think is very salient from George Longdon, the Executive Director of Family, Friends, and Grants Pass. And he makes several good suggestions that I think tie into what Representative Greenlich was seeking. First of all, this work group needs to have as its members such people as Gary Weeks, Susan Castillo, the head of OIA, et cetera. We had a previous task force that had representatives from these agencies, but they were mid-level administrators with no authority to make commitments to do old things in new ways. The work group should also have a board-certified child psychiatrist as a member. I think that's a good suggestion. Number two, this work group must have representation from people who live and work in rural communities. In the previous task force, there was just one person among about 25 who was from a rural community. The results of such groups is that they come up with urban solutions because they don't have a clue what life is like or how it's lived in rural Oregon. These suggestions are often of no value and not practical in rural areas. I'm going to skip a few, but the last one I think also is worth our noting. The reason for this bill's existence is to blend together the state and federal funding from education to Medicaid currently spent on these children and families that is not now coordinated and sometimes leads to schools telling family one thing and mental health people telling them another. This is a good goal. As with all goals, there's a right way and a wrong way. If it's done right, children and families will be well served. If not, families will needlessly suffer. Now, here's the point. Although the bill allows and encourages work group to, quote, consult experts, consultation costs money. There's quality professional literature available at little or no cost. There are reports on other states who have already created systems of care for the mental health of needs of children and families. The literature clearly documents what works and what fatal flaws to avoid. Alligators, I guess. The work group should use the literature and save us costly consultation fees. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Anderson, thank you for reading that into the record. We'll ask staff to make photocopies of that, make that available for the public and for the members of this committee. Thank you. Ms. Olson. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Madeline Olson, the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I'll be very brief this morning. The department is very supportive of the concepts in this bill. We're neutral on the bill because having just staffed a large stakeholders group on the Children's System Change Initiative, we know there will be some cost impact to the department that isn't in the governor's recommended budget. As Mr. Joondeff said earlier this morning, the Children's System Change Initiative for Mental Health lays a foundation. This bill, if implemented correctly, would give us the blueprint to build on that foundation. So we're neutral, and there is a small fiscal impact in them.
So, Ms. Olson, trying to tie in Representative Greenlich's concerns and Representative Butler's concerns, it sounds to me like we need this blueprint that you described more than just a study. It's a plan of action is what we're trying to accomplish with this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've been around for a while and was involved in the work to put together the Partners Project that's in Mr. McKechnie's testimony. And we were able to blend local school funds, child welfare funds, and some state mental health Medicaid funds. But it was very complicated, and because there wasn't a formal structure left in place, once the funding provided by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation left, it was not possible to sustain that. Now, Multnomah County's reworking that problem and trying to get that local investment back together, but it leaves it then to each local community.
Thank you. Representative Greenlight.
Yeah, in reaction to Representative Anderson's statement, this task force has five representatives of the Department of Human Services with a variety of techniques, I mean, a variety of expertises. Would it be better just to have Gary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the importance of having the varying levels of the department serve, whether they served as staff to Gary, and Gary was the representative with the voting power, it's because of the intricacies of the pieces of money that we need to be able to invest. Most of the money that we're talking about investing from the department will have a great deal of federal strings attached to it. And we want to do this in a way that doesn't have the department coming back in 3 years with a huge federal disallowance. So we would want to handle this very carefully, and for that, Gary would certainly need the expertise of his staff who understand those funding streams.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks, Madam. And I would ask the proponents of this measure to grab a copy of the email that we just entered into the record to try to think through some of the legitimate concerns that are raised in that. Thank you. Next, we will invite up a parent panel. Let's see where... We're going to invite Jimmy Boyer, David Hitt, and Kristen Anderson forward, please. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
I know you've been waiting quite a while, but I'd ask you to try to keep your comments as concise as possible so we can get through the entire agenda. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you.
Whoever likes to go.
Go ahead, ladies first.
Kristen, okay. Thanks. Great. And I just need you to state your name before you start your testimony.
Yes, I'm Kristen Anderson of Salem, Oregon. And my son has a serious mental illness, and my son is going to cost the state and society money. He can receive supporting community services and be a positive contributing member of society, or he can continue to display violent behaviors resulting in increased costs from increased juvenile police and court involvement. Either way, there's a cost. Potential for a positive return to society exists only if he receives appropriate mental health services. My son is 9 years old and has been in residential psychiatric care for most of the past 2 years. My dream is for my son to return to the community full time. He's in residential care because he assaulted school and after-school staff and other children. He harms himself. He's tried to kill himself and me. He has bipolar disorder, and this is a part of who he is. Medication, therapy, and training help, but there is no cure. Ongoing treatment is crucial for his success. In order to be safe in our community, my son needs to attend a school for behaviorally challenged children. He needs social and recreation opportunities that are closely supervised in a secure environment. With these supports, he can positively contribute to our community. My son has written and illustrated a book about his mental illness to help other people understand his illness. He's written a one-act play. He enjoys role-playing, drama, music, and other aspects of the arts. He's very interested in the sciences and would like to be an inventor or researcher. He often suggests ways we can help the poor kids and happily participates in local food and toy drives. With coordinated funding from juvenile justice, education, and mental health, my son could receive the kind of coordinated services he needs to stay out of institutions. Under current funding structures, that coordination is not happening, even though coordinated services and funding are essential for systems change to proceed. Just last week, my son's therapist suggested I may need to leave my job in order to be at home if my son's unable to be safe at a full-time school schedule, and that I will need to provide supervision needed 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. I'm a single parent with no outside sources of income. If I must leave the workforce, I will become a burden to society rather than a contributing member. I will be forced to depend on local, state, and federal assistance program. And the therapist said this is something many families have to do. I believe adequately supported and coordinated educational, judicial, and mental health services for my son would be the best use of the state's funds. Both of us would be able to contribute to society positively, giving the state a positive return on its money. This is the goal of House Bill 2362 and one that would help families like mine. And just as Representative Greenwich and Representative Butler have already raised, I would recommend a slight change to House Bill 2362. All the family members and mental health care professionals that I've met while working in the Children's Systems Change Initiative have acknowledged that such coordination and funding integration is essential for success, and I would recommend an amendment to form a work group to design a coordinated funding system rather than a task force to study the issue. Thank you for your consideration. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thanks very much, Kristen. I'm not sure we have a whole lot of time for questions, so we'll move on to Mr. Boyer. Good morning. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you all for listening. This is Fisher, my niece here.
Just need you to state your name, please.
Okay. My name is Jimmy Boyer, and I live in Portland. I'm in speaking today for perspective of my 14-year-old niece who has struggled for years with mental health disorders. Almost 4 years ago, I came to live with my aunt and uncle in Oregon. My mom has untreated mental illness, but she made the choice to let me live with them, and my aunt says that shows that she loves me. Because of my behaviors and serious emotional struggles, my new family had to make some difficult choices, like trying to work with a lot of different people to get me the right treatment. When I say a lot, I mean a lot. During the last 3 years, I have seen 8 different therapists, 6 skill trainers, 7 psychiatrists, or nurse practitioners. You might think this has to do with what adults call high turnover, but it has more to do with the fact that I have been treated in the hospital 4 separate times and received treatment from 4 different agencies and programs called intensive outpatient assessment and evaluation, residential, subacute, and treatment foster care. Almost every time I move, I have also changed schools, a total of 7 different schools I have been to. I was accepted into something called the pilot, which I heard is supposed to make fewer changes, but I sure have faced a lot of them anyway. A lot of times because of rules about money and how people's hours get billed if I am in a certain program or a certain agency. All these changes have been hard for someone like me who has unstable moods and who gets anxious and frustrated about transition. It also makes it hard for the people who are trying to figure out what I need. My most recent psychiatrist told my family that he can't really know what meds I need because I've had to move so many times and deal with so much transition. He also told me that I am resilient because I have survived. My aunt has felt angry and sad because she wants more than survival for me. She wants my treatment to be right so that I can be well. And she still believes in me. It has taken a lot, but I have learned that she will always be with me. I guess it is pretty amazing that I've been able to learn to trust anyone when you think about all the losses that I have suffered. Not just because I can't live with my mom and I've never known my real dad, but also all the staff and treatment foster parents who said that they would be there for me, but who came and went and are now doing other stuff.
Mr. Boyer, are you almost done with that
letter? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't really understand the money part of why this has happened to me so many times, but I hope that some people can figure it out and change things so other kids don't have to go through what I have. It is wrong that if I am having a lot of tantrums or trying to hurt myself that I have to change doctors and therapists because now I am transferred to a different program at the same agency or a totally different place. I've never been. Shouldn't the people who are treating me during a crisis be the ones who know me best? And why should my birthday be the reason that I get a new group of treatment people? Please make it different for kids like me so we can get better. I have told my aunt and uncle and a lot of other people that I wish I could be like other teenagers. I want to go to a regular school and maybe play basketball or something. My aunt has fought hard for me, so maybe I will get to do that, but it seems like there are a lot of other kids who don't have anyone to fight for them. Will you be the ones to do it?
Okay. I appreciate that description of our challenging system. Yes, Representative Bowen.
I just want to make a comment. I've been watching you hold the little baby in the back, and you do such a great job. I don't know if that's your baby or what.
Yes. It's our daughter, and that was part of the reason why she had been, my niece had been in treatment for so long, okay, because of safety issues.
Yeah, well, you certainly handle a baby well, I have to say.
Thank
Seems
you.
To come natural to you.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Okay, Mr. Hitt.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I'm David Hitt of Pleasant Hill. I'm a father of four children, two boys, 16 and 11, that I adopted, and two daughters, age 5 and 8. I'm here to tell you the story of our family and how services that coordinated across child welfare, mental health, alcohol and drug treatment, and education and other systems can give a family a second chance. Therefore, I ask you to support House Bill 2362. Our story is how a family successfully overcame an unhealthy lifestyle. 6 years ago, my wife and I had been arrested for drug and related charges. As a result, the state filed for termination of parental rights, placing three of our children in foster care and threatening to take custody of our unborn child. At this point, my wife and I decided to make a lifestyle change. Child welfare had no services to offer due to the pending parental rights termination. The state decided to offer us courtesy supervision so they could protect our unborn child. We then initiated our own recovery and services. After a year of drug court, after a year as drug court clients and accessing a long list of resources, the Attorney General withdrew the parental rights termination proceedings and required us to work with child welfare. At this point, and for the next 2 years, we were supervised and helped by a team. They included mental health, child welfare, our schools, our a court-appointed special advocates, our relief nursery, and there were some many other resources, places we got resources that we did ourselves. The team helped our family to develop our own longevity support system, made up of service providers, foster parents, and others who love our children, our church, those who sponsored us in recovery, a few friends, and members of our extended family. Our children transitioned home during those 2 years while we learned how to help each other, how to help each of them with their individual challenges that were a result of our past lifestyle. As a result of all the help we have received, now our children are having great success. Our 16-year-old returned last Saturday from a week in Mexico with our church, building two homes to help families down there. Our 11-year-old, who had a special needs, he's a member of the school wrestling team and no longer needs to be on an IEP. That's an individual education plan. Our 8-year-old, who was born drug affected, has exceptional behavior and is the top of her class and has learned to cope with her sensitivity disorder. And our 5-year-old is just completing her second year in Head Start and is looking forward to kindergarten. We are fortunate that all those agencies and programs did work with us in a coordinated way, while expecting us to change and learn how to be responsible parents. As a result of building a longevity support system, my wife and I have six successful years in recovery and have become involved in helping our families throughout the agency and helped us. And I'm asking you to be supportive of House Bill 2362. I would also like to bring to your attention the back of this. Has a article written by Bob Welch, and this sums it up pretty well, our life and how we've been successful, and it is documented. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for that story. Amazing
story recovery and success and onwards and upwards.
Yeah, I'd also like to say that I have a brother that has been in and out of the mental health system. He's been incarcerated, kicked out on the streets, and there's been no casework between the county, the agencies that have incarcerated him, and there's been no family, there's been no team to work through his problems, and he's just been kicked back on the street, and it's been a reoccurring thing. The agencies don't work together. There's no structure there whatsoever, and it's just costing the state thousands of dollars, having him in a state hospital, out of the state hospital, and there's just no in between. It's either in or out, or his life's just a living hell because there's no collaboration between the agencies.
Well, you may not know, but we've been spending quite a bit of time on the mental health system as a whole, the state hospital in particular, and the integration between the state hospital, community supports, corrections, and all that. So it's a long process, but we're going to get there. Okay, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you all. Thank you. We're going to hear next from Bruce Bishop, Angela Kimball, and I'm going to bring up Gene Schultz as well. Good morning, welcome. Bruce, you want to go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers. OATS is an organization of about 24 day treatment providers located throughout the state. About 2 months ago, we testified before you generally in favor of Hospital 2262. Because this is an opportunity to pull together the pieces of the children's mental health system and to integrate those services in a way that has not been done before. Last legislative session, the Assembly ultimately adopted a budget to address only mental health services, which does not include the other critical components of the mental health system. What House Bill 2362 intends to do is to bring those other players into it's critical that if you're going to make the kinds of changes that you're talking about, that everybody who's involved in children's mental health services be involved in those discussions. To date, your legislative policy has not made that direction, and the agencies are not following that path. 2 months ago, I testified that it is your responsibility to make that direction. That's still our recommendation. I think the 2362 is a vehicle for you to be able to do that and to pull those pieces together. But that's what we would urge you to do. There has been discussion about amending the bill so that it becomes a legislative activity with strong legislative participation and oversight. We think that would be inappropriate. A change in the bill because it is your responsibility to make the policy declarations and to pull those pieces together. That's the step that needs to be taken. The budget note last session did not do that. That's what needs to be done this time. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Before we go on, is there a D. Michael in this room? D. Michael? No. Okay. It's the chair's intention to complete the testimony on House Bill 2362, which is what we're doing right now. We're not going to be able to get to House Bill 3029, so we're probably going to set that over to some time next week to accommodate into the schedule. There's about, after this panel, about three or four other people still waiting to testify on 2362. try to get everybody's testimony in by 11 o'clock so that we can leave to attend the floor session. So that's kind of our game plan. And I'd ask Angela Kimball to go ahead.
Chair Delto, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and you have a couple pieces of testimony in front of you, as well as additional written testimony from family members. I'm here basically representing the Association for Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, which is strongly in support of this bill, but also I'm here as a parent. And really, I'm not going to take up your time repeating the stories of everybody else. I hope you read our testimony, but I do want to say one thing. I'm here because I have a passion about mental health issues, and this legislation is important. And it's important because it directs our bureaucracies, our agencies, to do something that we teach our kids to do in kindergarten, and that is to share and play nicely with others.
But see, we forget that at the Capitol.
Well, Chair Daldo, members of the committee, that's precisely why we are having to present some legislation, and we're not certain what final form or whether you do a legislative committee or entertain some other way to accomplish this. But if you can make everybody play together and share in the best interests of children and families, we would be most happy. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Chris Crane, would you come forward as well, please? And then we'll invite Dean Schultz to go ahead. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I'm not going to go through everything I've given you in writing because I realize there's a short time here and you haven't. But I just want to thank you for hearing from families. I think it's important to hear how a task force that seems very removed from them can really impact their lives, and both in the kind of successes people have when there is coordination and the failures that occur when there is not. While I was listening to your questions, I thought, what are the things that this really will do, this could do for families, and how can it change their lives? And a few thoughts that I had were that a coordinated integrated system that includes integrating funding could make it possible for there to be one plan that a family supporting their child can follow, that everybody that's helping them to be working on toward the same goals and toward one plan. There could be one eligibility process, one assessment process, and counseling provided by the people that they trust the most or are having the most success with them, and that the funding could provide all of that. And I think that is very different than how families experience services when they have multiple systems involved now. So, thank you.
Can you just tell me, in your organization, you have people calling in to get assistance? Mm-hmm. Is that how it works?
Yes, we have a 24-hour 800 number, and families call us when they're sort of stuck or trying to find out what to do or having a lot of frustrations with the mental health system or not having services at all. We refer them, and we also connect them with other families. So we are a network. We are a family network. So we connect them with other families who've had some experience. And this is a really important piece of support for them.
Okay. Jean, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your testimony. We have it here. Chris.
For the record, my name is Chris Crank. I'm the president and CEO of Albertina Care Centers. We have programs in up and down the Willamette Valley, but I'm here representing seven agencies who provide intensive psychiatric services for kids, those being Albertina Care Centers, Eastern Oregon Adolescent Multi-Treatment Center, Morrison Center, Scar Jasper Mountain, Riverbend Youth Center, Southern Oregon Adolescent Study and Treatment Center, the Christie School, and Trillium Family Services. You heard earlier from the Oregon Advocacy Center and Mark McKechnie as well, indicating that there's a strong level of agreement on this bill from many constituencies, and I want to assure you that this provider group of the agencies I mentioned is strongly in support of the concept of the bill. And we also want to note that the task, I think Representative Greenlick was, and several of you said, why don't we just do it? It's the old Nike way. But I think we recognize, too, that it's very complicated to deal with all the funding streams, the cross-system integration, and so forth. And so we believe this is a reasonable approach to take the next 18 months to figure it out. But I think we also agree that we should see an implementation plan, not just a study that comes out with some recommendations. Also, speaking for my own agency, we were pleased to be able to support bringing Wraparound Milwaukee into the Portland area as a part of the Family Foster Care Network, and also being the sponsoring agency for the project in Multnomah County, which will attempt to integrate the services from the multiple systems as well. So we're excited about that project, and unfortunately, or fortunately, the way these things seem to get done is by bringing in funds from other sources rather than the state taxpayers to get these projects off the ground. This one, if it will move forward, will be done again with Robert Wood Johnson money and the resources of the Northwest Health Foundation, and also resources from several of the public agencies. But I would echo, I guess, what Mr. Bishop said, that I think the legislature has the responsibility to create policy here and to move this thing forward. So wish you well, and we'll be glad to help you in any way we can.
I appreciate it very much. Thanks for coming down. Thank you to each of you. And we are going to now invite we'll invite the final three people up just as a panel. So if we have Janet Burton here, Janet can come forward, Jessica Stevens can come forward, and Randy Frankie with the Coalition for County Children and Families, come forward, please. Yes. Janet, you are signed up first.
Okay, thank you, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. My name is Janet Urton, and I live in Dundee. I'm a retired teacher and a member of NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, in Yamhill County. I am also the mother of three adoptive children, two of whom are diagnosed with mental health disorders. As a parent and an educator, I have many reasons to speak in support of House Bill 2362. As a parent, I can tell you that children with mental health disorders often have needs that do not fall into neat categories. When our son, who had attachment disorder, undiagnosed attention deficit disorder, and possibly depression, moved from occasional stealing and lying to running away and hanging out with gang members, we tried desperately to get help from various agencies. All too often, what he needed didn't exist, or he did not fit the criteria of what did exist. As a result, he currently resides in the adult correction system. Our daughter, who has bipolar disorder and ADHD, also has issues that cross boundaries. We have spent much of her life seeking help that often was not available.
Janet, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I have your testimony here. Mm-hmm. It's pretty well written. I just want to ask you a couple of questions to focus in on what we're trying to accomplish. I think we've heard a lot of testimony,
sure,
from folks about challenges that families and their children are having, and how our system needs to work better to support those kids. I wanted to ask you about what your perception is of the Children's Change Initiative and how you think this bill will help further the integration that's necessary to best support your daughter and your son.
Okay, well, currently I am involved as a family advocate with the Executive Oversight Committee for the Children's Change Initiative. I also teach a class for parents and caregivers of children with mental diagnoses. And over what I hear is there must be a flexibility of funding in order to do the things that are needed. Many times there are ideas that I or other parents are told, that's a good idea, but there's no program for that, or, well, there's no funding, that can't be funded, that can't be done that way. So my understanding is that we have to have that flexibility in order to have services that wrap around the child's needs. And my daughter currently is in a program where there is some integration within that program, and it's so nice to sit with a team and work together on a plan for her to meet all the various needs that she has. So to me, integrated funding means that money can be used in the most efficient ways to provide programs and services that truly meet the needs of the children at risk. I would also agree with others who have spoken, Kirsten Anderson, and with also representatives here, that this task force must be set up to create a blueprint for action, not just a study of the issues. My husband, Ted Erton, worked for over 10 years on this issue. He was a member of the Commission on Children and Families, and he eventually resigned because, as he put it, he got tired of being on a committee that planned to plan to plan. And the ideas have been around for a long time. We need to put those into action. I see this as a way of doing that, providing it is a blueprint and not just another study. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate your testimony very much. Jessica Stevens.
Chair Dalthall and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm representing SEIU Local 503. We represent DHS employees who do child welfare work, as well as employees of the Perry Center for Children and the Child Center located in Portland and Springfield. And we also wanted to just echo our support for this measure with one addition, which we've spoken to the chief writers of the bill about, and that is having a representative of employees at the table as well, and they're supportive of that change as well. Just to also wanted to address Representative Butler's earlier question about what do we do, what's happening in the intervening 18-month period, and just to remind the committee that there have been some recent changes around the mechanisms for funding for children mental health programs now, and that is new and developing and that folks are meeting about, and part of that is this goal of looking at a more integrated system where funding follows the kids as opposed to individualized contracts. So that change has just happened or is in the process of just happening now and is a new development, so we think it's an excellent use of time to actually implement a task force to establish a plan for a new system. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Randy Frank.
Chair, honorable members of the committee, my name is Randy Franke. I'm the legislative liaison for the Coalition of County Children and Family Commissions. The coalition has not taken an official position on House Bill 2362 yet, but they have put it on my watch list to monitor and follow and get a better understanding. This morning's hearing has been very helpful in that. So I didn't intend to testify, but I want to offer a couple of observations based on your discussions and questions. One is the membership. It seems awful heavy in state staff, and I realize those staff with expertise and various fundings are needed to put together a good solid implementation plan, but I'm not so sure you couldn't have that expertise available to the committee without them being actually on the committee per se and quite candidly increasing the number considerably. Along the same lines, that implementation plan, which I think has been spoken to before, is very appropriate. I mean, we've studied and studied. We need to have the implementation plan laid out and any legislation that might be needed for that implementation. For that reason, I guess I would suggest that you consider having more than one senator and one representative on it. If you indeed are going to come back with legislation, you need a few more, I think, folks to understand and carry that issue on both sides of the aisle and in both houses of this body. Second point would be, third point. Well, I've already suggested I thought the committee membership was a bit large to begin with. I guess I need to note that there is no local Children and Family Commission members noted on this committee, and again, I remind folks that our job is to coordinate services and planning at the local level, and while we mainly focus on prevention and early intervention and not so much the deep end, if you will, of service here, I think it's important that we're aware of what's going on and we're aligned and everything fits nicely. The current children's system change effort, an example, Jim Russell was up here earlier with the Mid-Valley work group on that issue. They're involving the local Children and Family Commission system on their ongoing planning effort on that issue, and it's very important, I think, to do that, and it would fit with this effort as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Randy. I think those suggestions make a whole lot of sense. So I thank the panel very much. I thank everybody who's participated in our hearings this morning. I apologize for the folks who are here on 3029 that we won't get to, but we'll have you back and work that out as soon as possible. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on
House Bill 2362 and adjourn our meeting for the day.